Chapter 36. The house was grand, Greek revival. Doric columns so tall, Duchess felt small beside them. An acre of tended grass ran to quaking aspen, bold green against spring sky. Duchess sat on a bench with Robin while planes wrote tracks into the sky. Shelley was inside meeting with a large black lady named Claudette, and she seemed to run whatever it was that needed running. Youth guidance home. Robin was quiet, resigned as they arrived at the house, but nervous enough to keep hold of his sister's hand. "I'm sorry," she said it with such sadness in her voice that he leaned his head on her shoulder for a moment. There were other kids, and they played a game of something complex, a ball and three hoops and a bat. Duchess watched for 20 minutes and couldn't figure the rules. She knew the look in their eyes, though. Kids like her, the damned. They didn't offer smiles or nods, just went about their day like it would be a miracle if they made it through. There was a lady outside on the street holding on to a girl no bigger than Robin and staring at the house. She had the wiry, strung-out look of a user. A half hour later, they ate together in a dining room that smelled of 100 dinners choked down by 100 kids. Robin pushed his food around. There was a communal lounge, a TV in the corner running a movie. A couple of girls sat on a brown sofa and watched, eating popcorn, but mostly ignoring each other. In the other corner was a chest spilling with toys, ranging from stacking cubes to puzzles. "Go play." Robin walked over, head down, and picked up a storybook far too young for him. He sat cross-legged on the floor, turning the page now and then, miles away from his sister in that room. In the hallway, she found Shelley. "I know what I did. I know I fucked up too bad." Shelley went to rub her arm, but Duchess stepped back. "What will happen now?" "I don't. Just say, Shelley, just tell me what will happen to me and my brother. This home is for girls." Duchess shook her head. Shelley raised a calming hand. "Claudette will let you stay with Robin on account of his age." Duchess breathed again. "What about Peter and Lucy?" Shelley swallowed, looked away at Robin, at anywhere but Duchess. "Did you tell them?"
"I had to. Peter, he's a doctor. And Lucy at the school, they... What you said about Mr. Price, they can't... Risk the...
I get it.
We'll keep looking. We just need to find the right fit."
"I don't fit anywhere." The look in Shelley's eyes almost broke her. Robin came out. They walked along the hallway and up the stairs. They passed bedrooms with kids inside, a girl reading a story aloud and her sister listening intently. The walls were colored pastel shades of pink and yellow. Pictures tacked to corkboards, family shots of fallen families. Their room had white walls, and the corkboard was bare, their time there unwritten. Two beds Duchess would later push together, the covers striped with rainbow colors. An empty closet and chest, a wicker basket for their washing. The carpet was squares that fit together like puzzle pieces, easy to lift out if they got stained.
"You want me to help you unpack?" Shelley said.
"I got it." Robin stood in the center of the room, looked up at the window, then pulled the drapes to cut falling light. He switched on the lamp and then climbed on the bed and curled away from them.
"When will Peter come?" he said.
Shelley looked at Duchess, and Duchess told her, all right, she should go now. Shelley said she would be back the next day to see them settled. Duchess went over to him and put a hand on his back.
"Peter and Lucy..."
He turned then, sat up and stared at her. She said nothing more, just shook her head. He reared fast, cursed her with every word he knew. He lashed out and caught her cheek hard. She kept her hands down, just closed her eyes as he yelled and screamed the kind of truths that no longer hurt her. She knew them already. She was a bad sister. She was a bad person. He cried so much, she shook. His face in the pillow, screaming for a life so close that for a few blissful weeks, he had it in his grasp. Duchess waited for him to cry himself out. It took a long time. She felt blood on her cheek where he had caught her. When he finally slept, she took his sneakers off and covered him over, and worried she had not brushed his teeth.
That night she heard noise. Someone as new as them across the hall in the small room. Crying, then Claudette, and calming words. Duchess scooted over into her brother's bed and watched him. She thought of Thomas Noble and how he would not be able to find them now. She did not know his address to write him. She could ask Shelley, but she knew she would not. She was nothing more than a footnote in his life, in dollies, in walks. She left no lasting impression, her impact ugly but mercifully brief. Duchess, Robin sat upright. It's all right. She stroked his hair. I had a dream. That dream again, I can't work out what the voice is saying. She lay him back down. Sometimes I forget where I am. She placed her hand on his heart till he calmed. But you're here. I'm here, she said. He reached up and touched her face. Did I do that mark there? No. I'm sorry. You never need say that to me. Spring drifted toward the promise of summer. As Walk and Martha prepared for trial, the Radley children started at yet another new school, rode the bus with the other kids from the home, and settled into the rhythms of another fettered life. Duchess still tended to Robin, cared for him like a mother, but did so without fuss, setting about her tasks like it was all she was good for. She tried her best to smile for him, to push him on the swing and play his games, run around the big yard and help him climb the oak. But she could not outrun her mistakes, feeling they were destined to sink not only her, but now her brother, too. Shelley still made her visits, Robin smiling when her hair changed from pink to a cobalt blue. He asked after Peter and Lucy at every visit, even asked for their address so he could write. Duchess helped him with the letter. He told them he knew he and his sister were not the right fit for their family and that it was okay. He asked after Jet, asked how hot it got over in Wyoming and how Jet kept himself cool. He signed off with love, then drew a picture of the group home and of him and Duchess. Stick figures with wide bubble heads and straight mouths, as if deep in contemplation of what might have been. He made Duchess sign her name, too. She scrawled Duchess Day Radley, outlaw, before he made her cross the last word out. She received a postcard from Walk. He'd been in touch with Shelley and she'd filled him in. He wrote her about Cape Haven, how it was all quiet without her, his writing so small she almost could not read it. The card was a shot of Cabrillo, Bixby Creek Bridge, the Ark in Big Sur, the water below breaking so hard she could hear it. She tacked it to their corkboard, along with a letter that arrived from Peter and Lucy a week later. They said everything and nothing. Told Robin it was hotter than Hades and Lucy had got sunburn tending the yard. Robin had made her read it 5 times, each peppered with questions she could not possibly know the answers to. They signed off with a drawing of their own, Robin and Duchess, from memory. Lucy was a decent artist, but she made the smiles a little too wide. Along with the letter, they enclosed a photo of Jet. That night, Robin slept with it by his nightstand, waking a couple of times and checking it was still there. The next day, Duchess tacked it to the corkboard, and their collection grew a little. Duchess began to tentatively think of the future, not her own, but Robin's. Her grades fell again as she drifted toward the lower end of her class. The other children left her alone, knew she was from Oak Fair, so might well be gone soon enough. And then one day, a boy named Rick Tide began to seek her out. It turned out Rick's cousin was Kelly Raymond, Mary Lou's sidekick. Rick heard the story, then he gave it a dressing and sent it on its way. By the time it made it back to Duchess, she'd been responsible for Mary Lou losing an eye. For her part, Duchess let it slide, even when Rick tripped her in the lunch line and sent her and her food to the floor. A day later, she popped Rick hard enough to send him to the nurse. Shelley was called and it was smoothed over. The principal knew enough about Rick Tide to keep it from spilling further. She was excused for the day, and Shelley took her into Main Street, where they sat outside a burger joint and drank shakes while the traffic crawled past. The road was coned for an upcoming parade. Flags were strung, and a banner crossed from one building over the street to the opposite side. Berry Parade? Sounds about the shittiest parade I ever heard of. Shelley smiled. You know what today is? I've been following. The first day of the trial, she'd been on the computer when the house slept and read all she could. You all right? Sure. Hal said it'd be over quick. They'll put him to death. Shelley sighed, her head tilted a little. Spill it, Duchess said. What? Whatever it is you want to say. Shelley hid her eyes behind sunglasses. I never split siblings. They're always better off together. Jesse James and his brother Frank, they robbed banks from Iowa to Texas. Cops got their gang at Northfield. Only the brothers escaped. They looked out for each other. Shelley smiled. I've been doing this job 20 years now, worked all over. I've seen all sorts. They pass through, on their way out, on their way back in. I placed hundreds. Each time I cried. I made it my life, and it should be, but there's no such thing as a bad kid, right? A trace of panic on her voice. You're not bad, Duchess. A truck pulled up. The same color as Hal's. Duchess felt the pain in her gut. Robin is 6. That's a good age. That's a real good age, but it doesn't last. Hard as that is to say, and to think even. Duchess set her milkshake down and stared into it. Do you know what I'm saying, Duchess? I know what you're saying. Shelley fished a tissue out of her bag, lifted her glasses, and dabbed at her eyes. She looked older then, like the years had run her down, the weight of such privileged, abject responsibility, night and day. I would die before I let go of my brother. It's not about letting go. It's about trusting his care to someone I've never met. And I've not met many decent people in my life. I don't like the odds. I get that. Is it a selfless act? Shelley looked up at her. Is it? Her eyes desperate now. Is it a selfless act to do that? He's so sweet, you know, he's so good and sweet, and he needs a better sister than me. Can you give him that, Shelley? I'm losing him. He's turning hard. I can't let that happen. He gets up in the night and he needs me. He calls out, and if I'm not there... Shelley pulled her in and held her tight. Fuck! It's all right. It's not. None of it is. I would never do it to you, Duchess. I wouldn't do anything without talking to you first. And I can see this isn't right. Siblings need to stay together. I'll keep looking. We'll find the right fit. I promise I'll keep looking. Chapter 37. Walk and Martha drifted through 3 days so torturous they drove back to Cape Haven and lay awake in Walk's bed, unable to clear the painted picture. The prisoner that spent 30 years planning revenge on the girl he could not have. Opening statements were brief, plans laid out, 7 minutes for Martha, 18 to the district attorney, Elise Deschamps. Deschamps was impressive. Lengthy list of credentials, smart clothes, black hair framed a pale face. Sincerity poured from her as she applauded the jury, told them she worked for them, for the state of California, and for Star Radley and her orphaned children. She was their voice, their justice. Proof would be overwhelming, premeditated, cold-blooded. Vincent King was a murderer. He took the life of a child, then the life of a fellow prisoner. Killing came easy. They would see they had no choice but to find the man guilty, and in doing so, pass on a sentence of death. It would not be easy, but she needed them. The Radley children needed them. Deschamps was skilled. Alumna of Yale Law, flanked by 2 associates who watched and scribbled and nodded at the right times. Clerks, bailiffs, the artist, the reporters. A small collection to watch a man's fate decided. Despite the grand theories, the expert way Deschamps lulled a jury, the facts presented were hard and incontestable. She brought in the pathologist from the state crime lab, who reeled off qualifications so towering, Martha moved to call, yeah, he could be considered expert. Deschamps barked, Judge Rhodes handled things well enough. Walk smiled as Martha held her ground. He saw Vincent do the same. The pathologist took them on the kind of journey that saw photos dealt. Jurors shake heads. One cried. He detailed blows, hard enough to break 3 of her ribs. He tracked the path of the bullet, the kill shot, into the chest, Likely she was dead before she hit the ground. Charts on easels. Anatomy spelled. A fingerprint guide took them through prints lifted from the Radley house. Vincent King had been in the kitchen, hallway, living room. They lifted one from the front door. After an hour, the jury tired. That Vincent King was at the scene was never in question. Another expert, ballistics, a hired gun to talk guns. And then of the gun itself, though it could not be found, the bullet pulled from Star Radley's body was a .357 Magnum. And then Deschamps ran like they knew she would. She pulled out paper and waved it round like it was lit. Vincent King's father had a gun registered in his name, a Ruger Blackhawk. She asked the jury to guess the caliber, the type of bullet it fired. Walk watched them close and saw each of them follow the ball way out of the park. On the cross, Martha tried to score minor points by getting the guy to admit that .357 Magnum, though a little less common, could still be purchased widely. The damage was done. Deschamps went on to detail Star's life, difficult childhood, her younger sister's tragic death, and then her mother's own death. She recounted the events. Vincent King sat there impassive, only closing his eyes when she talked of the strip of woodland where they found that little girl's body. Left to die, cold and alone. And then onto the suicide of Star's mother, how Star had found her, how that might have felt. And finally, brighter promise, troubled though she was, she doted on her children, Duchess and Robin, now settled into a group home in a town they did not know, at a school where they had to start over, 1,000 miles from home. Another photo, the three together on the beach. Walk had taken it himself on a rare day of calm. Walk was called as a state witness, along with a handful of first responders. First on the scene, he took his seat in the hallowed hall, cleared his throat, and told the truth in all its ugly. Blood on Vincent, calm in his voice. He did not slant detail, just laid it out and glanced at his friend now and then. Vincent offered him a slight smile. "It's all right. You do your job, Walk." After 8 days, the state rested. Walk and Martha went to the bar across from the courtroom, where they took a booth in the back and picked at fried shrimp fresh from the freeze. "How's Vincent doing?" "Oh, he's just swell," Martha said. "I've got half a mind to put him on the stand, let the jury see how calm he is. We call insanity, padded cell for the rest of his life. Beats the needle, right?" Walk picked up a shrimp, studied it, placed it back on the greased paper. "How long will you take?" "Couple of days. I'll say my piece, call my people, and then they'll get the case, and they'll put him to death." She stared into her soda. "You're doing good, Martha. Really, you look good up there." "Try not to look at my ass so much. It's predatory." "It's the shoes that get me. Your commitment to Chuck Taylor." She reached into her bag and pulled out a bottle of hot sauce. "You're kidding me with this. You actually carry it with you?" "Doubles up as mace," she poured liberally. "You notice I'm wearing a cross." She pointed to her necklace. "Jurors 3, 9, and 10, they're active churchgoers." She had done the consulting herself, sat through 2 days of torturous selection, struck a couple that had likely volunteered to execute the man themselves, moved for liberals only to see Deschamps repay the courtesy. "That gun," she sighed, "the bullet, like it wasn't bad enough." Walk took a steadying breath. "I have faith in you. You're just trying to get in my pants." Walk noticed she seemed anxious the next morning. They stood when Rhodes came in, took his seat on the grand chair between the flags. Vincent sat up front in a cheap suit that Walk had picked out, no tie. He flat refused. Martha called her own doctor first, Mr. Cohen. She'd helped his daughter out of a bind once. Another sorry story of a deadbeat asshole with quick fists. But Cohen was grateful enough to repay his little girl's savior. They went through photos of Star Radley's injuries. Both noted the severity. And then the photographs of Vincent King's hands. Slight swelling on the right, but likely old and likely from an altercation Vincent had gotten into a few days prior. On the cross, Deschamps got Cohen to admit he could not say for sure when the swelling occurred, and that a man of Vincent's size could inflict injury just as easily with an open hand. Martha moved on to the issue of gunshot residue, brought in her expert, a forensic scientist hired on Walk's dime, his dwindling savings amassed from a staid life. She was young but confident, held the room as she spoke. She ran them through the science, elemental composition, the chain reaction, the plume expelled during gunshot. No residue was found on Vincent King. Martha looked on during the cross, watched her expert admit the residue could have been washed off. The faucet was running, after all. Sweated off. Not been there in the first place if Vincent King had left the room right after firing. Walk took to the stand once again. This time he smiled, admitted he was Vincent's childhood friend, but that was a long time ago. He was actually the one who turned him in all those years back. His duty was to uphold the law, and he wouldn't let anything get in the way of that. And then Martha stepped at the front, took a breath, and fired her own kill shot. The butcher. Milton. Deschamps narrowed her eyes and straightened up a little. Martha had walked detail Milton's early life, how his father was a butcher in the shop he went on to run. Walk said he was an outcast, the kind of kid that others crossed the street to get away from. Deschamps objected, cited hearsay, but the point was made. That outcast had turned into a troubled adult. He was lonely to the point where he often got talking to vacationers and asked them to go hunting with him. Yes, Milton liked to hunt. She detailed the weapons registered to him. The list was long, and Walk watched the jurors exchanging glances. "Would you say you were close to Milton?" Martha stood by the jury box as she spoke. "I liked him. I felt bad for the guy. He always seemed a little desperate, but I just figured he was shy. He didn't have friends, no one he could call on. So he called on you. Sometimes. We went hunting together, just the once. I liked the eating, but not the killing." A couple of laughs. "So he was proficient with these weapons?" "More than that, I saw him bring down a mule deer from 1,000 yards. The man could shoot." Walk aimed his answer at Juror One, who hunted the Mendocino just like Milton used to. Martha moved it on, establishing that Milton lived across from Star, how he used to lend her his truck and take out her trash. "I thought it was decent of him," Walk said. "She had someone looking out for her." "Someone other than you?" "Yeah." Walk met her eye then. She was doing well. He was proud of her. Martha called her attention to Exhibit C. "Can you tell me what these are, Chief Walker?" Walk ran them through it, what he'd found in Milton's bedroom. Some of the jurors shook their heads at them, photos of Star in various states of undress. "And how many of these were there?" Walk blew out his cheeks. "A lot, hundreds. They were cataloged by date going back far." "An obsession?" Deschamps looked like she wanted to object, but held tight. "It looks that way," Walk agreed. "Now, you said Milton had a telescope." "He said he liked to watch the stars." Walk said it even and waited for the jurors to catch it. "But it wasn't trained on the sky." Deschamps stood, said nothing, and sat again. "So what did it aim at?" "Star Radley's bedroom." "And the cataloging, how recent did it go?" "Up to the night Star was murdered." "And the photos from that night?" "Missing. They haven't been found yet." Martha eyed the jurors. "And what did Milton say when you asked him about it?" "I didn't get the chance. We pulled his body out of the water last month." Gasps then, loud enough for Rhodes to quiet them. "He drowned," Walk said. "No sign of foul play." "Suicide." Martha let the word hang there as Deschamps got to her feet and screamed her objection. Martha withdrew it, but not before it had registered with everyone in that courtroom. Deschamps tried hard at redirect, color in her cheeks as she got Walk to admit they hadn't found Milton's prints at the Radley house. "He could have worn gloves." Walk didn't need to say it. The guy was a butcher. He wore gloves. There was no stretch required. The mood was better in the bar that night. Walk ordered them burgers and they ate in contented silence. Martha looked tired. The pressure so great. They talked a little about Vincent and how he hadn't reacted to Milton, just sat there like always, eyes down, ignoring the stares. "It was a good day." Martha chewed the straw in her soda. It's still too much, Walk.
He looked up.
It's too much to ignore. I don't want you to get your hopes up. This case was never winnable, but we've done all we can. Milton was fortunate, as bad as that sounds. But it'll take more. The gun, the bullet, the history there, the blood on his hands. Shit, I'd convict him if I didn't know him.
But you do know him, right?
The jury don't.
He walked her out, installed by her car. You want to come back?
Closing arguments tomorrow, early night for me.
He watched her leave, then climbed into the cruiser and headed back to the station. It was late. Leah Dunn, the place in darkness, but he hadn't stopped by since the trial began.
He found a stack of papers on his desk, hit the lights, and slumped back. He fished through the mail, opened a couple before he came to it. Verizon Communications, Dark's cell phone record.
Boyd had come through for him.
There were pages going back a year, numbers so small, Walk had to squint. He'd get back on it once the trial was done. He flipped them, eyes blurring as he yawned and stretched. He didn't expect to get anything. But then he found the date, December 19th, the day Hal died. It didn't register at first, his eyes glossing over digits he knew well enough. He focused again, expected to see something different. And then he dropped the paper to the desk. The call to Dark's cell. It had come from the Cape Haven Police Department. She cried. He watched. They sat in the yard. The Cape slept. She had been awake. The shadow beneath her eyes told him she did not sleep anymore. She blinked dark tears of mascara. A full moon above highlighted the sorrow. Leah Tallow wiped her eyes, sniffed, cried some more. He had walked over to the house in silence, trying to find another answer, desperately searching for it.
You want to tell me?
There was no attempt at lying. She stared at the grass, calm set in like she'd been waiting. We've struggled for a long time.
He drew a long breath, hoping to stave it off a moment longer, knowing once it came, it would change things.
It's money, Walk.
He watched the tortured look.
Ed, the business, it's all gone.
Gone? She looked up.
Connect the dots for me here, Leah.
She stared back at the house.
Tallow Construction, it's been in Ed's family 70 years. He took it over from his father, who took it on from his grandfather.
It used to turn a decent profit.
It used to employ half the town. Jesus, Ed still has 15 men. We pay them out of our savings most months. And then Ed's father died, and he left us the house on Fortuna, second line. Not much. A lot for us, but not all that much in the real world.
You could have sold the business, cut the loss.
Ed wouldn't. He loves this town, Walk, like you do. But we need the change, the new homes, the new money, and you blocked it, you and the others. You voted it down whenever you could.
Last I heard, it'll go through regardless.
But it's too late for us now. You buried us, you know that.
He let that sit a while, wondered at his role, his need to keep Cape Haven from moving on without him, without Vincent and Star and Martha. Dark, he said.
Then she took a breath. He bought the Fortuna house from us for cheap. In return, he had the contracts lined up for Ed to pull it down, and the rest of the street. Construction. Ed would get them. All those homes, condos. It would save us, Walk, and save the Cape, the real Cape, the locals that were born here.
But it's gone now. All of it.
Not yet.
I don't understand.
The King House, the insurance. Duchess Radley has the tape. If she just gives it back to Dark, then the insurance will pay out and we'll get it back.
He let that settle, his mind spinning. How much? Leah swallowed.
All of it. The house, second charge on the company, credit cards and loans, shit, everything, Walk. We couldn't even afford to keep me on. That's why I pick up all the extra shifts at the station.
Walk watched the moon, then glanced back at the house. Does Ed know what you did?
No, I keep the books. Ed is a fucking idiot. He thinks I don't know. The women. Always perfume on him.
You sold out a child. She shook her head, the tears falling faster.
He wouldn't hurt her. You don't know, Dark.
He wanted to take her hand. Despite everything, he'd known her a lifetime. He steeled himself. How did you find them?
Emotion left her. She went on, callous facts laid bare. The call, I knew it was Montana. I filed your receipts. The gas station. And then Hal said the name of the school on the phone with you, and the lake by the farm.
You listened in? He said, stunned.
The facts took his breath. He rubbed his eyes, the back of his neck, felt the heat in his cheeks. He stood, felt his knees weak, and sat again.
Your hands are bloody, Leah.
And for what?
For your husband's business?
For them, she said loud and pointed at the house. For my kids, for all the families we support in this town. It's just a tape, a fucking tape walk. Duchess burned the club down. We all knew it, but you didn't do anything about it.
That's not...
It is, Walk. You know it is. You and Star and your fucking misguided loyalty to Vincent King. Star was his girl. You promised to watch out for her. I know that. You told me you'd do anything for your friends. Same as in high school. If you did your job, if you brought the girl in and...
Where's Dark now?
I don't know.
He watched her.
I don't. I swear it.
Duchess, he's still looking for her?
It's about the money with him. It's always about the money. He wouldn't stop with my help or without.
He thought of Martha then at home, running over her closing argument. He killed a man. That's on you. She cried hard.
I can't think of that.
Shit, Leah.
There's people in our lives that we'd do anything for. You know that better than anyone.
That night he walked the streets of the Cape till sun breached the night sky and the day found him. He stopped by the Radley House, Milton's place, Main and Sunset. He stood by the King House and thought of it being knocked down. Even if Dark didn't come through with the money, then someone else would buy it for less. He thought of shooting hoops on the driveway, of hiding out in the old attic and looking at Rich King's playboys. There was a chance they had it right, that Milton had done what Martha said. Maybe Vincent was institutionalized, or maybe he just hated himself so much that he'd rather be put to death than go on living as a free man. There were still so many questions without answers. He knew there was a chance he'd colored it a shade it never was, but still, he felt it in his bones. Vincent King was innocent. And he wouldn't leave it to chance, not anymore. He'd come so far, he would get to the finish, even if it cost him his soul. Chapter 38. That morning, Walk stood in front of the mirror and shaved. He watched the basin fill. His face emerged, pale, gaunt, sick. He did not dwell, just splashed his cheeks with icy water and took a long and heavy breath. And then he drove to Las Lomas and took his seat and ignored the looks and whispers. Leah Talla was let in. She looked calm. Makeup hid the night before, simple dress, heels. She met Walk's eye as she passed. He did not smile. Martha ran her background, how she'd worked admin at Cape Haven PD for 15 years, sometimes dispatch. Part of the furniture, like Walk and Luann. She spoke confidently, stuttered a couple times, but Walk could see the jury liked her. He'd called her early, told her everything. She'd agreed in a second. A truce of some kind. The repercussions could wait, but this could not. And then he'd called Martha and told her. And in her voice, he heard the doubts, and he knew with some certainty that he was jeopardizing everything they both held dear. The system? It's a running joke. Let's just say Walk likes things how they were, not how they should be. Martha smiled at Walk, who raised his eyebrows. Juror 7 caught it and laughed. So, I've been trying to overhaul it for years now, trying to get the file room sorted out. See, they brought in new templates 4 years back, new forms and coding. And the way Walk does it, I mean, there is an order,
organized chaos. Deschamps stood. Rhodes moved it on. Martha apologized. So, I've been at it 3 months now. I'm up to 1993. And that's when I found it. Martha held up the paper. Deschamps objected. The judge called him over to the bench. Walk heard heat in Deschamps' voice, red face as she turned, shook her head once and returned to her seat. Rhodes allowed it into evidence. Can you tell me what it is? Martha said. It's a break-in report from November 3rd, 1993. Number 1 Sunset Road, the residence of Gracie King. Vincent King's home, the house he returned to after his release. Yes. Does it say what was stolen? Yes, Chief Walker was thorough, like always. He went through it with Gracie King, Vincent's mother. Turned out she forgot to lock the safe. They took $200 in cash, a gold brooch and some diamond earrings, and a handgun.
A handgun?
Yes, a Ruger Blackhawk.
Murmurs till Rhodes quietened them.
Deschamps went back to the bar, argued some more with the judge. It got heated enough for Rhodes to call a 15-minute break. Walk took the stand next, did not need to introduce himself or run his credentials again. Martha ran him through the break-in. He spoke with calm. He did not meet Vincent's eye once, though felt the stare. And then Deschamps was up.
I feel a little blindsided here.
Leah only found it last night. She works evening sometimes when her husband can be home with the kids. It bothers her more than me, the system. I know where everything is. So, Chief Walker, if you know where everything is, how come you didn't bring this to attention earlier?
I forgot about the break-in.
You forgot?
She looked at the jury, confusion on her face.
You grew up with Vincent King. You knew the family. You used to visit him in prison. It doesn't strike me, with all that's going on, as something you'd forget.
Walk swallowed and took a last breath. He knew it would change after all of it.
I'm sick.
He looked around the room, reporters at the back, a line of watchers. He felt the quiet, the eyes on him. I have Parkinson's disease. My memory is not what it was. I haven't told anyone yet. Thought I could deal with it. I guess I didn't want to lose my place. He glanced at the jury and saw compassion, and then across at Vincent, who watched him with sad eyes. And then he looked down at the break-in report, and he knew that if they studied it, if they looked hard enough, they'd see a slight lean to the scrawl like it was written with a shaking hand. Closing statements began at 5. Rhodes said he'd rather give the jury the case late than move into another day. Martha was up first, and she took the floor, every eye on her. She didn't use notes. Walk could imagine she'd had a late night. She was brief. She detailed the facts. She spoke of Star and the tragedy that became of her. She talked of the Radley children and how they deserved justice, but for the right person. And then Milton, the facts could not be denied. She painted a portrait so tragically accurate that the jurors sat mesmerized. And then on to Vincent. She asked them to imagine entering the prison system at 15 years old, a frightened child in a prison with the darkest men. She spoke of his regret, his battle to serve the hardest time he could. Maybe he was institutionalized, maybe he did kill a man in self-defense, and maybe he did make the kind of mistake you don't ever deserve to recover from. But that didn't mean he'd killed Star Radley. And his silence did not speak of guilt, but rather a crushing self-hatred that burned so fierce he'd rather be punished for another's crime than take his place in a world where the child he'd killed could not. 1,000 miles from that courthouse, Robin found the yellow flower from a rabbit brush and brought it back. Duchess helped him flatten it, then pin it to their board beside Jet. She placed an arm around him, her mind elsewhere. Rick Tide had begun again, trying for a rise. A kid that did not know when to quit. He'd spit on her back, told her that was from Mary Lou. She'd gone to the bathroom and washed her shirt, thought of Walk and how he told her to be good. That evening, after they ate, Duchess took Robin out to the swing set in the big garden
and pushed him before a sun that sat blazing beyond the trees. He squinted and smiled, and she told him he was a prince. Then she helped him ready for bed, brushed his teeth, and read him a chapter from a story about a pig named Wilbur and a spider named Charlotte. "He's an emotional pig," Robin said. "He is." That night they said a prayer. Robin looked over to his sister, and she made him close his eyes and steeple his fingers. "Why did we pray tonight?" he asked. "Just checking in." After he fell asleep, she crept from the room. She passed the beds. The forgotten children slept, dead to the world for those precious hours when they could forget their place and occupy another. The room in darkness, just the television glow. She flipped channels till she found the right news station and watched as reporters gathered outside the courthouse. She'd called Walk, collect. He sounded beat as he told her the jury would think on it, that they could come back any time at all. She guessed it was soon. Her mind ran to her mother, to the past year and all that came with it. She turned and saw her brother standing in the doorway, his eyes fixed on her. "You're not in the bed."
"Sorry."
He walked over and sat beside her, and they watched scenes so distant it was hard to believe their connection. They saw reporters fill, cut to commercials. In silence, she sat and wondered what was on her brother's mind. When they returned, they ran through the trial and detailed things they did and did not know about their mother and about Vincent King. When the verdict flashed red, she sat up, heart beating fast.
"What does it say?"
"They said he didn't kill Mom." She watched, mouth slightly open, as the reporter found a juror. The man looked tired but still managed to smile. He detailed the testimony of the Cape Haven chief of police, how the cop had found a break-in report that showed the suspected murder weapon, a gun once owned by the suspect's father, could not have been in the possession of Vincent King. The jury had been on the fence. It gave them the out they needed. She got a pain in her stomach then, so bad she pressed a fist to it.
"Walk! What the fuck did you do, Walk?"
Robin nestled close and she kissed his head and questioned everything she thought she knew about the world. It had tilted on her again. The concept of truth, the implausibility of fair. And then they saw him, and Robin stood. On the screen, accompanied by a small woman in a smart suit and Chuck Taylor's, was Vincent King. The room lit with the flash of the city's camera, an innocent man being led to a waiting car.
"What is it?"
she asked her brother. He shook. His whole body trembled as he struggled for breath. He began to cry as dark pooled and spread from his pants. She dropped to her knees. "Robin, talk to me." He shook his head, clenched his eyes, closed tight.
"It's all right, I'm here."
"It's him," breathless, crying. "I remember." She cupped his face gently.
"What do you remember?"
He stared past her at the screen.
"Vincent was in my bedroom. I remember what he said."
She wiped his tears as he finally met her eye. "He told me he was sorry for what he'd done to Mom. He told me to say nothing or I'd regret it." He closed his eyes and sobbed. She held him tight. She led him back to the room, put him in the tub and showered him off, then dressed him in fresh pajamas and tucked him into the bed. He slept. And then she packed. In her bag, she found a photo of Star with them, one of so few in their yard, barefoot and laughing. She tacked it to the corkboard along with a photo of Hal. She cracked the blind to Star's and then took her seat at the foot of his bed, where she sat for night, hours so long and quick as she recounted their time. She thought of his birth, first steps and words, all the ways he made her laugh, his first day of school, how she taught him to toss a football in their small yard. She stayed till first light. He would not wake alone in the dark. She pulled her bag to the door and propped it gently open. Then she returned once more, and she held back her tears till she could no longer breathe, cursed herself, and pulled at her hair like the mad girl she was. Had she a knife, she would have cut herself deep. She deserved it to hurt. She deserved all the pain. She leaned, kissed her brother's head, told him to be good,
as she slipped from his life, like so many before. Chapter 39.
Walk sat at his desk, found the bottle of Kentucky in the drawer, unscrewed the cap, and took a long drink. He closed his eyes to the burn, didn't feel all that much like celebrating. Vincent had gone right home. He did not speak on the ride. He did not smile, just shook hands with Martha May. Walk told her she did good, met her eye, and knew that Martha knew. Victory was hollow. The district attorney had stormed from the courtroom. He drank a little more till the night softened. His shoulders dropped. His body stopped exhausting him. He looked over at the stack of papers piled high on his tray, going back a year, mostly routine. He had ignored all but Vincent King and Dark. The one thing they hadn't lied about at trial was the state of Walk's office. He pulled the stack and began to thumb pages. Luann's scrawl, traffic violations, vandalism, possible trespass. He found it hard to focus, hard to recognize what used to be routine. He caught a couple of memos from state, and then, amongst it all, he saw a message from a Dr. David Udo returning his call. Walk scanned his mind, the frustration growing before he settled on the autopsy of Baxter Logan, the man Vincent had killed in Fairmont. He checked his watch, saw it was late, but dialed the number. The man answered on the first ring. Turned out Udo was working his last week, preparing things for his successor, 2 decades younger, more than a lifetime less experienced. They made a little small talk. Walk ran over the Logan case. It took Udo a minute to locate the file, a man who knew the order.
"What more do you need to know?" Udo said.
I guess the detail, I just wondered.
"We weren't as stringent back then. No DNA to look for. I noted cause of death. Head trauma."
Walk sipped his whiskey, his feet on the old desk. "So that was it. One punch and not one punch. Not the way Logan looked." Walk stared into the glass.
"I remember Cuddy called. Of course, he was young then. He hadn't yet taken over from his father, but he told me not to waste that much time on Logan. Sex offenders aren't all that popular at Fairmont. I noted cause of death and moved on to the next."
"The beating was bad?" Udo sighed.
"It's been a long time, but some of them, you just don't forget some of them. Teeth gone, both eye sockets shattered. His nose was broken so badly it pressed flat to his face."
"But it was a fight. Vincent King was fighting for his life."
"I'm not sure what you want me to say here, Chief Walker. It was a fight, but Logan was beaten long after it was over."
Walk's mind ran to Star. 3 ribs snapped like that. He thanked Udo and hung up. He swallowed, tasted the whiskey still, his throat drying up, heart beginning to race away. He stood, left the station, and made the walk. Night now, nothing to see but distant light riding the waves, the steady pull of boats crossing the bay. He breathed salt wind, moved slow enough, tried collecting his thoughts, but they ran and formed pictures he did not want to see. Along Brycewood Avenue, neighbors he knew from the summers before when the town was his. He stopped at the end of Sunset when he saw Vincent across the street, back to him, moving fast, dark jeans and shirt. He thought of calling out, instead followed, far enough back. He wondered how the man felt, death to life. Along the street and up 2 minutes, and Vincent climbed over the gray wall, dry-laid stone, jagged against soft streetlight. He walked up to the wishing tree, not breaking stride, just bent quick, and then he was up, glancing back and around. A car at the top of the street, falling headlights up and over the hill. Walk moved into the shadow. Vincent, spooked, moved on, at pace, away from the beams, into the night. Walk watched the car pass, and then he climbed the wall and dropped to long grass. At the tree, he felt around, blind, then took out his cell and lit the base. The hole, close to the dirt, small enough to miss. He knelt, reached a hand in, and pulled out a gun.
Chapter 40.
"Those footprints on the moon," Thomas Noble said.
The Apollo astronauts made them, and they'll stay there for at least 10 million years.
She saw sky no longer endless. She knew about souls and the prophetic, about divine reunion and a world to come. She tried not to think of Robin. If he woke that morning frightened, she swallowed a lump of such bitter shame she almost cried out.
Where will you go?
I have business to attend to.
You could stay here.
No.
I could come with you.
No.
I'm brave. I took a blue eye for you.
For that, I will always be grateful. They lay at the end of his yard. The woodland behind made shadows of them.
What you've been through, he said, it isn't fair.
You sound like a child, the notion of fair. She closed her eyes.
You know nothing good will come of any of this.
A star bled from the sky. She did not make a wish. Wishing on stars was for children. And Duchess knew she was no longer one of those. She wondered if she ever had been.
All these people, Duchess said, they spend a lifetime looking to the sky and asking questions. Does God intervene? If he doesn't, why do they still pray?
Faith, the hope that he will?
Because otherwise life is too small.
He spoke again quietly.
I worry you won't find a way back.
Duchess watched the moon.
I used to ask God about my hand. Why? That kind of thing. I used to pray I'd wake up normal. You know what? Those were wasted prayers.
Maybe they're all wasted.
Stay here with me. I'll hide you.
I have to do something.
I want to help you.
You can't.
You want me to just let you go alone. Is that brave?
She took his good hand and they linked fingers. She wondered what it would be like to be him. His troubles so slight. His mother in the house, sleeping. His future so unblemished. So wide open like that.
They'll look for you.
Not all that hard. Another welfare runaway.
You deserve to be found. And what about Robin?
Please, she said, so close to the edge. They might come see you.
Cops. They might come ask you where I am and where I'm going.
You'll think about telling that you know what's best.
And if I do,
you don't. She lay till morning. His mother left early, dressed in workout gear, her Lexus creeping silent from the driveway as Thomas Noble opened the back door. Duchess went into the Noble house, washed up, and ate cereal. There was a safe. Thomas Noble took $50 and handed it to her. She fought to say no. He stuffed the bills into her hand.
I'll pay you back.
She filled her bag with a couple of cans, beans, and soup. She moved fast, saw Shelley was moving faster because the telephone rang and the machine picked it up. They listened.
She sounds worried.
She has 1,000 more like me. At the door, she saw bags ready to be packed. Thomas Noble would go on vacation in a few days. He would forget her. His life would go on. She smiled at that thought. Outside, the street woke, garbage truck at one end, mailman at the other. Thomas Noble wheeled out his bicycle and leaned it against the gate.
Take it.
She went to say no, but he placed a hand on her shoulder.
Just take it. You'll get further before they pick you up.
I'll be a ghost. I already am.
Will I see you?
Yeah. They both knew it was a lie. He let it go, leaned forward, and kissed her cheek. She got on the bike, bag over her shoulder, all she had in the world.
Later, Thomas Noble.
He raised his good hand as she rode down his driveway and into the street. Then she pedaled hard, not looking back, wind streaking her face as she left the light roads behind and sought out the dark. An hour, and she was on Main Street. She left the bike out front of Jackson Hollis Funeral Parlor and stepped inside, the central air hitting her so hard her skin pricked.
Duchess, Magda said with a smile,
nice to see you again. Magda ran the place with her husband Kurt, a man that shared pallor with his clientele. He must have been with someone because the drape was pulled, the coffins hid.
I wanted to collect my grandfather's ashes.
I wondered when you'd come. Shelley said she'd bring you one day.
She's in the car.
Duchess nodded toward a Nissan across the street, parked at an angle that blocked the view. Magda headed out back and returned a minute later with a small urn. Duchess took it, turned to leave as the drapes parted and Dolly came out, Kurt behind. Duchess slipped out and onto the sidewalk, made it almost to Cherry's before Dolly caught up with her. Duchess? Dolly led her inside and sat her down in the corner. She went to the counter and ordered for them. Dolly had aged, makeup not quite so perfect, hair not curled so neat. She still wore the names, Chanel bag and shoes. I'd say it's nice to see you back here. But, Dolly smiled. I'm sorry about Bill, I didn't know. He was ready. Turned out I was not. Duchess's bag lay open, the clothes, the cans. She pulled it closed and zipped it. Dolly looked at her with sadness. What will you do now? Duchess asked. Bury my husband. Beyond that, I haven't given it much thought. There were trips, places we wanted to see. I don't know if I'll do it alone. But he had a good life, that's all we can ask, right? Thomas Noble talks about fair. Dolly smiled. I get that. Fair means someone is in control. I heard about the man. It was on the news. I thought of you and of Robin. Maybe that's what Thomas Noble meant. About how someone goes through life causing pain to others, and some people just try and get on. The two always seem to collide. Duchess thought of Dolly, her life, her father, impression cast. Hal said that man was the cancer of our family. His reach is far, to me and Robin, to my brother. I can't. Dolly reached over and closed a hand over hers. Maybe you don't choose who you get to be. Maybe it's predefined. Some of us are outlaws. Maybe we find each other. And maybe it's all nothing. No one in control but the person willing to go out and take what they want. Do you know about justice, Duchess? Three-fingered Jack, he rode 500 miles to avenge the death of his partner, Frank Stiles. But what do you think it means? And I don't mean to find. I mean, what do you think it means for the people that get hurt? An end? I could take it back to breathing, but I know that's not enough. And for Robin, what do you think he wants? He's six. He does not know what he wants. He does not know a world beyond the immediate. And you? I know too much. The waitress came over with two cocos and a small cupcake with a single candle in it. She placed them down, winked at Duchess, and then returned to the counter. Happy birthday, Duchess. Duchess stared at the cake. You didn't need to... Hush now. It's not every day a girl turns 14. You need to make a wish. When she realized Dolly would not quit, she leaned forward, closed her eyes, and blew. Outside, they walked the shaded side of the street. When they got to the parlor, Duchess picked up the bicycle and wheeled it along. Dolly stopped beside her truck. There's a lot I should say here, but nothing I don't already know. Will you come back to the house? There's something I'd like to show you. I can't. I have to get on. Another time? Sure. Dolly took her hand. Promise me you'll stop by one day? I will. And I know you'll make good on that. An outlaw is only as good as her word. Dolly looked frail then, written with concern, like Duchess was even close to being her problem. I can check on Robin. Duchess nodded, a slight tremble in her lower lip. She would have to get tougher for what would come. You stay safe, Duchess. And then Dolly reached into her bag and took out her purse. As she began counting bills, Duchess got on the bicycle and rode. She turned at the end of Main. She waved, and Dolly raised a hand. Duchess made it to Radley Land an hour off noon, legs burning, t-shirt damp through, hair slicked down. She buried the bike in grassland by the gates and walked slowly up the winding driveway beneath the praying trees beside the dead water. She thought of Robin, if he was at school now, if Shelley was with him. It took all she had not to break from her path, return and fall to her knees and take him in her arms. She'd kept one photograph, him smiling, a year back when his hair was longer. She took it from her bag as she climbed the old porch steps and sat on the swinging seat. There was a board back on the gates, Sullivan Realty, There would be an auction one day in the future, and someone else would move in, take care of the land, run the same tired circle. In the distance, Duchess watched elk, clustered like always at the foot of the hills. The fields needed tending. She thought of Hal out there, a lifetime alone. At the Red Barn, she opened the door and saw his tools, still where they were, nothing of value to anyone. She crossed into the shade and walked to the rug and dragged it back. She pulled up the door in the floor. It was heavy. Sweat dripped from her chin. She propped it and walked down the steps. A low store, guns on shelves, a rifle rack. An old leather chair, Hal's place where he could be alone. Beside was a small table, and on it a thick stack of letters. She thumbed them, settled on the last, and opened it. And as she did, two papers fluttered to the ground. She picked them up, two halves of a check. She pressed them together, swallowed dry. $1 million. Postdated, a couple months after the trial was due to start. The signature was simple, more like print. Richard Dark. On the back, she saw Vincent had endorsed it, signed straight over to Hal. She placed it all back, thought of the cost of atonement, warmed by the thought of her grandfather ripping it in two. She stood. Across, she saw boxes. She walked over, took a knee when she saw the colored wrapping paper. Gifts. She checked the tags, saw her own name scrawled, and then her brother's. There were dates on each, going back each of her years. She sat back on the low rung and tore one open. A doll, then another. A puzzle. She did not open any of Robin's. She stalled at the last one dated that day. She opened it with care, took the lid from it, and swallowed when she saw what was inside. She lifted the hat out and admired it. Leather studs on the band, vented crown and 4-inch brim. She thumbed the tag, the intricate gold. John B. Stetson. And then, slowly, she placed it on her head. The fit perfect. She took two guns, hers and one of his. She took a box of bullets, the kind he'd shown her. When she was done, she placed everything back, loaded her bag, and felt the weight. His ashes drifted away by the water in the spot they sometimes sat. She steeled herself and dipped her hat. So long, Grandpa. Chapter 41. Walk spent a day dodging calls from above. News traveled quick. He would be summoned to Governor Hopkins' office, where they'd talk over his replacement. No doubt offer him a desk job. Three calls so far that day, like they ran with the assumption he was nowhere near fit to serve. He sat at his desk, the file spread out, Milton's bloated face staring at him. The man had no family to speak of, a distant aunt that lived in a care facility in Jackson. He'd called, she'd claimed she did not know a Milton. He looked up when he saw her at the door, tried to smile, but it was hard. Martha closed the door behind. "You've been dodging my calls, Chief?" She said it with a smile. "Sorry, I've been busy here." She sat, tilted her head, and raised her eyebrows. "Truth?" "I haven't been able to face you." "You hustled." "But I didn't want to hustle you." She crossed her legs.
"I'll get over it. We both went into this with our eyes open, right?"
"I think me more than you."
"I've got business coming in now. Fuckers on death row want me to run their appeals. Forget it. Give me deadbeat men and broken down women. They're my bread and butter."
She ran a hand through her hair, and he watched every move.
She reached over, tried to take his hand, but he drew it back. "Talk to me," she said.
"When we started this, I only saw the end.
I saw Vincent walking free and the clock rolling back.
That was enough for me. That was my end game.
I'm sick, Martha. My cells, they're dying.
What's happening, this is the early stage. It's just the start."
"I know that."
"Do you? I've read up, spoken to the doctor, seen others in the waiting room further down the line than me."
"So what are you saying?"
I don't want you to be a carer. I want more for you. I always did.
She stood. You sound like my father, like I'm some little girl that doesn't get a say in her own life. I choose. You're my choice. And I thought I was yours.
You are.
Bullshit. You choose yourself. Your fucking noble, dependable self.
He looked down.
She wiped her eyes. I'm not sad. I'm mad. You're a coward, Walk. That's why you left it all this time.
I didn't think you'd want to see me.
Well, I did.
I'm sorry.
Don't fucking say that. All these years you could have reached out, come seen me. Shit, even picked up the phone. It was Vincent that made you, like he always did.
That's not...
When I asked you about the Vincent you remembered, you highlighted the good and didn't say shit about all the times he fucked Star over. All the girls, all the times she cried on my shoulder. You used to cover for him. Even lied to me. You always covered for him.
It didn't mean anything.
I know that. I'm just saying. You've lived the past 30 years for someone else. Isn't it time you stopped?
She strode to the door, then stopped and turned and jabbed a finger toward him.
When you're done, when the pity party is over and you find your balls again, you call me.
The door opened and Martha brushed past Leah Tallow, who turned and watched her leave.
Is she all right?
He stood, closed the door, and ushered Leah into the chair opposite. She wore no makeup, hair pulled up, face drawn. He took his seat.
Are you sure you want to do this, Walk?
Yes. He watched as she dialed from a burner cell. Dark did not answer. Leah waited for the mechanical voicemail.
I know where they are. Call me.
Leah's voice caught as she spoke. Tears fell as she cut the connection. When he calls back, you give him this address. You tell him the kid is friends with Duchess and might know where to find her. Walk slipped her a piece of paper, the handwriting just about legible.
Don't do this, Walk. I'll speak to Boyd. I'll tell him everything.
He watched her, what was left, and he tried to hate her, but could not. She knew to head south to the bigger town, Fort Pryor, where there was a bus station. She did not know how far $50 would get her. She guessed not far enough. Maybe Idaho, Nevada, if she was lucky. She decided right off to look no further than the day ahead, any more, and the task at hand reared up and pushed her back. She rode single tracks, kept her pace slow. When the climbs began, she got off and pushed. When they dropped, she went with them, hand pulling the brake, cautious. Montes, Comet Park, areas of outstanding beauty all hidden by enveloping trees and shadow. Pretty houses spaced far apart. Yellow signs calling for votes on Keystone pipelines that would pump life into stalling towns. The few trucks outside a grocery store. Nothing more than the twitch of death. 2 miles from anywhere, she got a flat. A blow that brought her close to tears. She tried to move onward, the bike slow now, each pedal double the effort. She cursed as she dumped Thomas Noble's bicycle in the woodland beside Jackson Creek. She sat on a fallen tree, ate bread already turning hard, drank the rest of her water, then moved off on foot, her sneakers not up to the land, the skin pulled from both heels. She passed farmhouses and patchwork fields, every shade of green and brown. Trinity churches that still had bells and people to ring them. For a mile, she trailed an old couple, rambling gear, long sticks, and easy smiles. She listened to each of their steps. Though she kept off the trail, she at least had some sense of direction. They would be heading somewhere. She was still sure it was south. She lost them, cursed again, feeling weak and thrown. She came to a road so big and long and empty that she stopped beside and tilted her head toward the sky. And then the old couple reappeared, Hank and Busy from Calgary. Retired, vacation, staying at motels and hiking trails, looking through old eyes at new sights. She fell into step with them, gave them half a story how her mother was sick and she was heading into the hospital in Fort Pryor to see her. They gave her water and a candy bar. Busy spoke about her grandchildren, 7 of them scattered, a banker far east, a doctor in Chicago. Hank walked in front like he was scouting the land, moving branches for the ladies, his neck red from the sun. Hank noticed her limp. Soon had her on the grass while he fished through his bag and found pads that he taped to her heels. Poor girl. They moved again. Hank had a map and he pointed out Lake Tethin.
Another lake? Busy said and made eyes at Duchess. I used to live in a town called Cape Haven when I was small.
That's a pretty name, Busy said. She had powerful calves, hiking legs.
A broad face, handsome, not soft.
Do you remember it well?
Duchess batted black fly from her face as they emerged on another trail.
No.
They crossed Route 75 and took a road not wider than a truck. She did not question as Hank moved with such purpose. They were staying half a mile out of Fort Pryor and would get her there safely. She was due luck, long due.
Do you have any siblings? Busy asked.
Yes. Duchess saw Busy wanted to ask more, saw it in the sad smile and watery eyes. She let it go and the moment drifted high above them. An hour of walking and they came to a set of gates at the curve of a road that climbed so far its end could not be seen. Beside honeysuckle and flowers that were dying, they pushed through because Hank said they should stop for a little bit. The house emerged, large and stately. They walked to the front and looked up at the stone, blocks bigger than her head, windows ornate and pretty. Hank looked around and Duchess watched him, clutching her bag tight and checking her guns.
The house is Attaway. Hank likes architecture.
Hank pulled out a camera and snapped off a dozen shots. They circled to the back and saw neat and long bodies of water that stretched to woodlands.
Smoke, Busy said and pointed.
It rose from a fire by the clearing. Another couple, same age, same look in their eyes. Like they'd found heaven a decade before they were due. Introductions were made, Nancy and Tom from North Dakota. Had an RV back at Harston Dam but wanted to see the Attaway house. They ate grilled hamburgers. Duchess thought of Robin, checked her watch and saw he would be eating now alone. He would not eat without her. She got a pain in her stomach so bad she clutched it. At sunset, they made it to the motel. Fort Pryor was a 10-minute walk. Hank filled her hands with candy bars and another bottle of water. Busy hugged her tight and told her she'd pray for her mother. Duchess walked downtown, her feet aching a little less. Dark fell on the mountain behind, a couple of lights, a diner, Stockman and Bob's Outdoor. She found the bus station on the corner across from a body shop, shiny cars lined as streetlight bounced from their hoods. Inside was a black lady at the counter, not Busy enough for Duchess's liking. She guessed Shelley would have called the cops and maybe they would have taken a look at the farm, spoke to Thomas Noble. She doubted they'd have put anything more together.
How far can I get with $50?
The lady peered over her glasses.
Which way are you heading?
South, California.
You alone?
You don't look old enough to... My mother's sick. I have to get home. She watched Duchess, tracing her features for something. The lie, maybe. Decided she didn't care enough, so turned to her computer.
Buffalo, it'll set you back 40.
There was a map behind plexiglass. Duchess found Buffalo. It looked a long way, but nowhere near far enough.
It doesn't leave till morning. You want to think on it?
Duchess shook her head, pushed her money over the counter.
We're closing up soon, she said, as Duchess eyed the cushioned bench. You got somewhere to go?
Yes. She handed over the ticket.
Where do I go from there?
You want the quickest or the cheapest?
Do I look like I got money?
A frown, then another look at the screen.
Cheapest seats I got is Denver, then Grand Junction, on to L.A.
Long way, girl.
Still a lot of money.
Duchess left the bus station. She had $17, a bag with two guns, a little food, and a change of clothes. Outside a bar named O'Sullivan's, she found a payphone, picked up the receiver, but realized she did not have anyone to call. She wanted to speak to Robin. Not even speak, just listen to him while he slept. She wanted to kiss his head and pull him close, sleep with her arm around him. She found a park, a cluster of trees and a playground. She slipped into the woodland and lay back on the grass. In her bag, she found a sweater and spread it over herself. At an hour when the town still slept, she hiked the half mile, each step heavy, leaden, every muscle resisting. The motel was quiet, not even a clerk, not anyone at all. Big Sky sign, color TVs, vacancy. She walked along the lot, family cars in front of each door, a cluster of trees that rose high above the low roof of dark tile. Drapes over the glass, she moved to the door with the Bronco in front. Calgary plates. Hank and Busy, their window wide open. That was them, unworried. She laid her bag down and took the gun from it, and then she said a silent prayer as she climbed through and into their bedroom. A shape that was Hank, sheet covering, dead to the world. A day of hiking would do that. Just enough light to make her way to the chair where his pants lay. She fished the pocket, found a wallet, a photo of smiling children inside. She could not swallow as she slipped the bills from inside, could not breathe because her chest ached. And then she saw Busy, eyes open and sad. Duchess reached behind and felt the gun tucked into her jeans. The old lady said nothing. Duchess was broken as she left. It was her job to remind them, to let them know the world was not good.